Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer John Herr. John Herr grew up in McKeesport, Pennsylvania. He worked for several news organizations, including United Press International, Business Week, and WQED-TV. He specialized in national labor reporting and wrote three nonfiction books from his reporting experiences. He'll be reading tonight from his novel, Monongahela Dusk, published by Autumn House Press. Welcome to Prosody, John.
Thank you very much, Ellen.
How about we start out tonight with you reading some from Monongahela Dusk?
Okay, I'll be glad to. Many of the listeners may have driven through McKeesport recently and seen what a mill town looks like 2 decades after its mill has closed down. You may be surprised by my take on downtown McKeesport during its heyday right after World War II. In this scene, in late 1945, Pete Bonner, one of my main characters, who had been wiped out in the 1929 crash, has become prosperous. He had started a beer distributorship, which benefited greatly from wartime wages. April 1945. At 8:30 on a Monday morning, Pete Bonner leaves May in charge of the business and drives uptown to do some banking. His old Pierce Arrow succumbed some months ago to a burst oil line, and he now drives a secondhand 39 Buick. He finagles the car into a coupe-sized curb space on Fifth Avenue and, with time to spare, takes a stroll up the main street. It is a mile-long brick gulch winding between seamless rows of narrow, 3- and 4-story, sooty red buildings with ground floor storefronts and upper level offices and rooms to let. Built during a mad commercial spree shortly after the turn of the century, the buildings stand joined at hip and shoulder, their formation broken only by occasional alleys and cross streets. And if one building leans to the east, the entire block, like a rank of drunken sailors, inclines in that direction. Windows topped with ornate wooden lintels and drip moldings import a heavy-lidded, dopey appearance to each facade. 2 blocks away, the watchworks rumbles and sputters, awake all night, pouring out steel that will help defeat fascism. Bonner continues his stroll, enjoying the shop owners opening rituals, unlocking doors, turning on lights, raising blinds, sweeping off the sidewalk. There are hundreds of tiny shops where mostly poor merchants grub out a mostly honest living. For Bonner, this is the heart and soul of the city. He nods hello to Harry Futch, the skinny optometrist, who is wrestling with a man-sized cardboard cutout of eyeglasses in his storefront window. Bill Hobbs, the butcher, his apron already bloodied from hacking at hindquarters, stands in front of his shop, arguing baseball with Sergi, the garbage man. Early bird shoppers are swarming in and around Balsamo's fruit market. Old men in threadbare suit coats pick over apples and pears. Old women in babushkas waddle homeward, carrying in each hand a stout brown bag brimming with vegetables. Next comes a second-run theater district, 3 movie houses in 1 block. Stopping under the marquee of the Victor, he watches a workman on a wobbly ladder prying out yesterday's feature presentation letter by letter. The Victor will open at noon in time for men to catch a movie before the 3:11 turn. A poster promotes a coming attraction, Meet Me in St. Louis with Judy Garland. Clang, clang, clang went the trolley, says the blurb. Get happy-hearted at MGM's glorious romance. At this time of morning, deep shadow enshrouds the entrance to Jefferson First Federal, where people stand waiting to deposit what's left of Friday's paycheck. At last, a thick glass door opens. When his turn comes, Bonner deposits a thick wad of bills and checks comprising Saturday's receipts and asks the eye-shaded teller to compute the new balance in his savings account. Back on the street, he feels so good, he would jump in the air and click his heels, if he could get more than 2 feet off the ground. Money, money with no liens against it, money not owing, money unattached, profits free and clear. Real money and Bonner have been reunited. Real money opens up all kinds of investment possibilities. He feels as if he's been hibernating, afraid to show his head. Now he's emerging from darkness, taking a fresh look at the world. It's time to re-enter the marketplace, gauge business activities, nose out deals. By mid-morning, Fifth Avenue is jammed with automobiles and streetcars, sparks popping on trolley wires, traffic cops impatiently waving drivers through intersections. Crowds of shoppers surge this way and that, pausing in front of store windows, men's stores, women's stores, shoe emporiums, Murphy's 5 and 10. People dart across the street between car bumpers. Sidewalks glitter with specks of graphite deposited during a recent volcanic slip in one of the Watts' blast furnaces. It seems you could scoop up that glitter by the handful, just like pocket change. Money generates money, he exultantly tells himself, remembering how, back in the 20s, invested $10 bills spawned $100 returns from which magically blossomed stocks, bonds, and notes worth thousands, on paper anyway. Fast money and fast times in those pre-Depression days. Now he has a second chance, has made a second chance, with the help of war wages. Despite May's feeling that there's something tawdry about the beer business, beer has been good to them. Money is good if you use it to build to make more money and build more things, and so on and on. Noontime in Mulkey's Tavern, the working man's bar and grill, men up from the mill on lunch break, down from their homes on a day off, women not welcome. Crackle of sizzling fat on the big slab stove, lined with neat rows of yellow-eyed eggs and bubbling chunks of ham, bacon, and sausage. One short order cook performs spatula wizardry on the grill just inside the front window, while his co-worker at a cutting board slaps together sandwiches on hard black sour bread stacked with kielbasa, pastrami, salami, corned beef, and marbled head cheese. Bonner skirts the lunch line and stops at the bar where men are hoisting beers, chomping on sandwiches, chawing on big dill pickles plucked out of a briny barrel. He remembers Depression days when people stood outside in groups and watched, salivating, as Connie Mulkey himself worked at the grill, basting a lonely fried egg. The hungry no longer stand watching. Now they come in and partake. America as she ought to be.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer John Herr, reading from his novel, Monongahela Dusk. So, John, you were a reporter for a lot of years and have also written three nonfiction books, and now you're in the world of fiction. And I was just wondering what interested you in starting to write fiction now?
Well, I was in the world of fiction at a much earlier age than even as a reporter. When I was in high school and college, I was writing fiction, never very well, of course. And then later I completed two novels that have been unpublished. So, but I had to earn a living, of course, as we all do eventually.
Sure.
And went into journalism, which was a second choice, really. I wanted to write the rest of my life and have people buy my books.
I think I know a few people with that dream.
So, yes, I worked in journalism for a long time and tried to write fiction during that time, but was not very successful. It's too hard for me. Maybe some people can pull it off, but I couldn't do two things at one time.
No, I hear that quite a bit as well. It's hard because you have to create that kind of imaginative space, and you have to really pay attention to the craft of the writing, the same way that you do the craft of whatever your work is at the time. So do you feel that you write differently when you're writing fiction? Is there something that you feel you can do more of or you do less of when you're writing fiction than kind of writing?
I feel much freer when I'm writing fiction because it's all coming out of my head. It's not coming out of rows and of figures and facts and interviews that I've done and books that I've read. It's all coming right from here and what I feel inside and what I have seen. I became interested in writing this particular novel after I finished a long book called And the Wolf Finally Came back in the late 80s, which essentially was about the union management relations in the steel industry before the debacle. When I finished that book, 600 pages of facts.
Wow.
I desperately wanted to do something else. And I had a whole storehouse of memories from growing up in McKeesport gnawing at me, wanting to jump out of my head. And besides that, by then I had developed an idea about what the issues were in the Monongahela Valley. As a younger man, I really didn't understand it. Now I thought I understood it somewhat. Mm-hmm. And I decided to put the two things together and write about people in the Monongahela Valley caught in this terrible downward spiral.
Sure. And did the main character of Bonner, did he come to you right away?
Yes. Yeah, pretty closely. I started out with two things I wanted to do. For some reason, I remembered Route 40, which is an existing highway running south from southern Pennsylvania into Maryland and so forth, and a famous old highway. And my dad and mother and myself and my sister used to drive on family outings down Route 40. And I just remembered for some reason, it stuck in my head, an historic old highway where there had been Indian fighting in the 18th century. And so I started off with Route 40. This would be a way to start a novel, to get scenery in the picture and to get something moving right away instead of some momentum moving.
Sure.
Then I had to have a character, and I thought of a man that I knew, well, actually was my father. Part of the character Bonner is based on my father. It's not a completely true account, but...
That's where the fiction comes in.
That's right, yeah. I embellish quite a lot because I did not know nearly about... As much about my father as I put in this book about Bonner. And so that I also wanted a union man, Mirovich. And I had known a lot of people like Joe Mirovich. Well, not a lot of people like Mirovich. I'd known a lot of people in labor. Mirovich was a somewhat unusual kind of character. And I put the two together. And I then tried to construct a plot that would last for several years and take me through a number of different changes in the national economy,
yeah,
and political trends. And so
we have Monongahela Dusk.
There it is.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer John Herr, reading from his novel Monongahela Dusk. John, would you read some more for us?
I'd be glad to. So the second major character is Joe Mirovich. He's a former coal miner, and by 1943 is an officer of the Steelworkers Local Union in McKeesport. It's a fictional local union, by the way. In this scene, he's driving up in the Monongahela River with his girlfriend in 1943 on their day off from the mill. During the war, she also works in the mill, as did many women in this area. She's a smart, independent young woman who doesn't know quite what to make of Joe. During the drive, they begin talking about the union and the company. Mirovich says, "See, I got this theory. Long time ago, the companies came up with a plan to build all these mills on the river close to the coal. They separated them by patches of woods and bad roads, so as the men in one mill didn't know what was going on in the next mill round the bend. That way, there was no solidarity. Well, we finally got the union into all the mills. Next step is to get the union into all the men." "And the women," she says. "Right, women too. And when the war's over, we'll get rid of this no-strike pledge and take on these fat cats." She runs her eyes across his hard profile, dark, handsome, but for the scars, and most of all, tense. She turns away thinking. They have been dating once or twice a week for about a month, going to movies, kissing and squeezing on her porch, talking about the union and the people they know. She finds him honest and funny and always angry, a man who stands up to the bosses and fights for the working man. But what else? "So this is what it's to be," she says, "taking on the fat cats. This is Joe Mirovich now and forever." The suddenness of it draws a sharp glance, then a slow grin. "I think my pick struck a vein," he says. He thinks for a few moments, leaning to the left as he negotiates a bend. "I wish I could say it better, but here goes." He takes a deep breath. "It doesn't look like I'm going to discover a new medicine or play the piano in a monkey suit." He stops abruptly. "What a load of BS. I'll tell you honest, Mitz, I used to think my mission in life was to hurt people. I mean evil people, like the co-operators who squashed the life out of my pap and others like him. I won't make any bones about it. I still want to cut those bastards down to size. That's the only thing I ever wanted to do, get power for us workers. Why should management run everything? Why should they make all the decisions, produce so much here, lay off those bums there, do like this, do like that? We should tell them how to make steel. You want to run the company, she says. I want to run the union with a say-so in running the company. See, I had a little part in forming this union, and I'd like to see it do some good things for our people. What else, she says, as if she's a teacher, leading him. The union has got to be more than just a wage machine. We got to get equal rights for us hunkies and the coloreds, too. And we have to clean up this valley. It's disgraceful living like this, dumping sewage in the rivers, drowning in soot, breathing coal smoke, playing the numbers. He shakes his head. Maybe that's the worst thing, the numbers racket. They take our money and the company takes our lives.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer John Herr, reading from his novel Monongahela at Dusk. You know, one of the things I noticed in your book and really appreciated, John, is you have a lot of strong women characters in your book. In fact, at times they seem to be, they can hold their own as well, if not better, than some of the men in the book. And I was wondering what inspired you in terms of, I mean, was that also some of the women that you had met, you know, during your research when you were as a journalist, or women that you knew, or were they just women that came to you?
It's a very interesting question. I'm glad you mentioned that. I like to think that I try to make strong women, make them in a literary sense. I wrote a book before this one, a nonfiction book about a union of women at Harvard University. They represented staff members at the university, and they had to struggle for 17 years before Harvard, that great liberal institution, was willing to recognize them. And in doing so, I learned a lot that I hadn't known before about the women's movement. And my wife then taught me the rest of what I needed to know about that subject.
Good for her.
She doesn't call herself a women's liber, but she, believe me, she knows what she's, what women deserve and what they should get. And so that helped a lot. And then I did know some strong women when I was growing up. And then in my research as a labor reporter, I met some fascinating women. I'm glad you noticed that.
Yeah.
Part of it.
You know, that was one of the things I was thinking, too, kind of just in terms of crafting the book. A couple things. One is that you obviously had to have a pretty vast knowledge of labor movements and unions because you'd been a reporter in the field for so long. Did you find that you still had to go back and do more research, or was a lot of this kind of, you know, you were a walking library on the subject?
Interesting way of putting it. I'm not exactly big enough to be much of a library, but... I think I had most of it in mind already.
Yeah.
I had done so much research for other books. A lot of it dropped away, but not the essential parts.
Sure. And then the other thing I was thinking is, you know, there's a number of writers that say that they can't write about a place until they leave the place. Just because I think there's something in that gap between the distance of living there and kind of the memories. And then I know, you know, even as I travel back and forth to places where I've lived, and I'll come back and I'll think about how it is now compared to how I knew it then. And did you find that? I mean, did you write about McKeesport at all before this book?
I wrote about it, but not very well. And not in nearly as intense a way that I wrote about it here. I suppose that there's a good bit to be said for that feeling, that theory. When I think back on things, I think what you've expressed is a good way of explaining why you develop memories that become so acute. They want to spring out of your head, I find. And those are the ones then that you can write easiest about. At least that's the way I am. And then, unfortunately, the memories may be partly wrong, but then that's the way all of us see things, isn't it? We don't always see everything correctly the first time.
Sometimes that's where the best storytelling comes from.
That's right.
Did you travel back to McKeesport at all, or did you do any looking at old photographs? Because, I mean, that's also part of it, too, is that it's a different place now than it was then.
Much different. Well, I'd been coming back to McKeesport for many, many years after I left as a reporter, because I did a lot of reportage in the steel industry. And so I would come back to Pittsburgh and visit the mills in the area, come back to McKeesport, and got to know people in the local union very well. And then that was during my journalistic career. Then to write the novel, yes, I did come back. There were a couple of things I wanted to clear up. I took another long drive over Route 40 to see where that went and to see what there was to see on each side. And took a drive around several streets in McKeesport and other parts of the valley that I thought I remembered. And it turned out I had remembered them fairly well in a topographical way, but now I had a better way of writing about them.
Sure. Talking with John Herr, he's reading from his novel Monongahela Dusk. John, would you read some more?
All right. And one thing I tried to do, Ellen, I wanted to write a story that had two components. There was a story about the place, and then there was a story about the people. And I knew I had to be very careful not to let the place overwhelm the people, because as a reporter, that's what you do. You let the facts overwhelm knowledge, actually, in the end.
That makes sense, yeah.
And certainly the facts overwhelm emotion and the feeling. And so I had many versions of this novel, and at the beginning, the early version suffered from too much place.
Okay. How long did it take you to realize that?
A number of years.
Yeah, I can imagine, especially, I think, given our conversation just a minute ago, the idea of you're trying to recreate a place that doesn't even necessarily exist as it was back then. And so that can get kind of consuming. And then it's great you had the editorial kind of eye to go back and say, oh, too much place. I got to pull some people forward, some other issues forward.
Yeah, it took a while for me to understand that. But fiction, in my mind, and I'm hardly an authority on it, but should be, well, there's no should be, number one. but it seems to me that fiction works best if it's about stories about people and how they get along in the world. And it just so happens that this is a very strong place, too.
Sure.
And I wanted to put the two together, and the story about the place is a story of, rise and decline. And people want to know why the decline occurred. And to some extent, I don't try to say why the decline occurred. Who am I to say that? I wrote 600 pages in a nonfiction book, and I didn't get it all in. And even then, after finishing that book, I wasn't even sure why it had happened, whether the steel abandonment happened anyway.
Yeah.
Because there were so many facts and so many possibilities, so many players, that one nonfiction book could not begin to describe it all or get to the essential end of it.
Right.
So I was trying to say something about that in this novel in a fictional way.
Great.
Okay. So what I'm reading from now is one of the hints about one of the many things that happened to the place. It is April 1949. Pete Bonner, the McKeesport businessman, has become even more prosperous since the end of the war. He's seeking a financial partner for a plan to build an aircraft parts factory in the Monongahela Valley. In this scene, he and his old friend Gas Stowe, who made a fortune as a natural gas wildcatter, are looking up and down the valley from a high bluff. Bonner's trying to interest him to become the main financial backer for his plan. They have been walking back and forth across the property, Stowe listening intently. Now they stop where the transit sits on his tripod. Stowe moves a few steps to his left, as if to take a neutral stand, and gazes out over the valley for some minutes. The clouds and smoke keep moving around, coming together, pulling apart. Stowe takes a look through the transit scope, handling it like the old surveying hand he is. He sees plumes of smoke spurting from smokestack after smokestack, planted in factory after factory, steel mills, tin mills, glassworks, metal shops, foundries, pipe mills, furnaces, powerhouses. Where's that coming from? He indicates a white blob hovering over the farthest ridge up the valley. Bonner shields his eyes and looks uprange. I'd say that's from the Clairton coke ovens. We can't see Denora from here. Too far upriver. The citizens of Denora can't see Denora, Stowe says, slowly swinging the scope. What a sight. I've got five whole steel plants in my sight, and I can't even see Denora and Manesson. He rotates in a half circle, and going downriver, there's McKeesport, Duquesne, Braddock, Rankin, Homestead, and I can't see the two mills in Pittsburgh. He removes his eye from the scope and says, musing, the largest concentration of heavy industry in the world. Those old steel guys and financiers really laid it down, didn't they? All that money, that investment. They ripped out the old valley floor and laid down capital like linoleum. They took out plenty, too, Bonner said. Yep, they took it out in bundles, Stowe said. He walks downhill, craning his neck for a view of the river. As he reaches the brink, Stowe turns and puts a hand on Bonner's shoulder. Pete, listen. A steel-consuming industry is a good idea. But nobody in his right mind would invest in this valley. Look at that stinking river. You stick your big toe in, the acid will burn it right off. Look at that sky. Nothing but smoke and haze. Look down there at all those narrow, crammed streets. Look at the riverbank. There's not a pretty sight in the whole damn valley. Stowe kicks at the turf. Anybody who's ever made money in this valley, he didn't put it back in, not after the first 10 years. Carnegie sold his steel company, built a few more libraries, and got the hell out. I studied it, see. The dozen or so guys who invested in the original Carnegie Steel, all of them became millionaires. Not a one of them reinvested in western Pennsylvania. Now, Dick Mellon, he's leading this campaign to clean up Pittsburgh. Is he building any plants out in the valley or cleaning up those mill towns? Ha, he knows better. Bonner stands stock still, gazing out over the valley. My theory is, Stowe continues, you develop industry in a town or a valley, you put money in, and then you start taking money out. Once you do that, the place has become a mess. It's a taking from place, not a putting into place. When I look ahead, I see this valley 50 years from now, a sinkhole. You don't invest money in a sinkhole.
Well, believe it or not, John, just as you've gotten us back to World War II Monongahela, we have to end and come back to contemporary Pittsburgh. So thank you so much for coming tonight.
Thank you, Ellen, very much.
That was the fiction of John Herr from his novel Monongahela Dust. You've been listening to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a bi-weekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in every Tuesday night at 7 for Prosody on Independent Public Radio, 91.3 WYEP.